Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Jillie Jeezy. I'm here with Judge Michelle Lawrence. Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Hi, Jill. How are you?
It is so great to talk to you. This has been a long day for both of us, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it was a full court day, and a lot of interesting things are happening in the courts.
Yeah. What's happening in the courts?
Well,
Tell me something good.
The civil unions are happening.
Civil unions in Illinois. We had a couple of cases filed.
Yeah.
Okay. And?
And so a couple of cases are filed, so that's good. And everybody seems to be very eager to get on board and start handling these kind of cases. So
that's good. And what are you handling with these civil unions, Michelle?
It's the same as divorce court. It's exactly like divorce.
Okay.
So I had some gay friends, and I said, are you going to do civil union? And they said, no, why would we want the state involved in our lives? So it's it's not across the board that everybody wants this.
You know what, especially the state of Illinois, because we don't do very many things right there. I mean, we've got the biggest laughing stock for a former governor on trial just across the street from where you work right now, and we're waiting for that jury to come back. We've got debt beyond imagination, but we do have the civil unions bill, and we are doing terrific things with divorce and parental alienation. I can say that.
Well, that's for sure, and everybody is starting to really pay more attention to the shared parenting concept.
Absolutely.
It's not... The doors that have always locked so quickly are starting to crack open a little bit.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I'll tell you. I was talking to some social workers yesterday at the Institute of Psychoanalysis, which is very prestigious and very devoted to helping families. Mm-hmm. And the Institute for Grieving is there. And I know you know who that woman is.
You're talking about the Barr-Harris Institute.
Yeah.
Right.
Which focuses on grieving.
Sure.
And I was asking them whether they had ever done studies on the grieving process and alienation. And they were they hadn't done studies, but they totally agreed that there was a whole grieving process. I said, but it's not just the parents. It's the children who are never allowed to grieve. That's the problem. Instead of grieving, they have to shut that part of their brain down.
Well, they have to lock so many things down.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to choose.
But anyway, my point was they were really, and I was talking to them about shared parenting, and I was talking about the studies coming out mm-hmm. where the children worried the most about whether or not they're going to see that other parent in the traditional parenting mode. Which is every other weekend, which is the non-custodial, having about 16%. And I was talking to them about it, and they were very open to it. They said, well, what do you think is the answer to the anxiety drip that the children in divorce cases are undergoing, which keeps them in constant stress? And I said, more parenting, more shared parenting. And they completely said it makes complete sense. They're pretty cutting edge over there, as you know.
That's terrific. And hopefully, you know, we've got so many people that we talk to in Illinois because it is, as it is in every other state, rampant parental alienation and visitation interference. So we've always need people to refer to. We always have parents asking us, where can we go? Where can we go? So the Barr-Harris Grief Center is a great place. We've got Jay LeBeau. We've got, you know, Dr. Starr, we've got so many people in Illinois that are terrific. But on the phone tonight with us, we have one of the stars of parental alienation, Dr. Mike Bone. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you wonderfully.
Okay, good, good. I didn't know.
Where are you? Are you in Winter Park?
Yes, I am. I am
you
indeed.
Are.
How are you all both doing?
Well, it's a whole different recipe since I know you now. You know, it's the last time we interviewed you. I didn't.
That's true. That's right.
Jill did, but we did, for the people who are listening, we did the program on parental alienation. And
in Chicago.
In Chicago.
Right.
And Dr. Bone was sort of the keynote speaker.
Sort of. No, he was.
Well,
the
we didn't use
speaker.
No, the sort of the word keynote, not sort of. That he was the MVP. Do we follow MVP? Are we good with that?
I like MVP. I like that a lot.
Well, I'll let you make that designation. I'm not.
No, you can't. First of all, it would be so unhumble and not attractive.
Okay.
You know how that goes.
And we know that he has both of those qualities.
That's
you know,
right.
So we don't want to, you know, despair his character. So let's just move on.
So
yes,
let's
you,
move
please,
on
yes.
from his character to a lively subject, which Jill calls the most popular, unpopular subject.
The most unpopular. Well, before we get to the most unpopular subject, the most popular, unpopular subject, I want to say that I am in Rochester, Minnesota tonight doing the show from here from Mayo Clinic. So live from Mayo Clinic, and Michelle is in Chicago, and Mike is in Winter Park, but I cannot get to the chat room on this stupid little iPad thing that I'm doing the show from. So I have asked Wendy Archer in Dallas to look at the chat room and call me with questions. But if you have a question for Mike, I need you to call 347-539-5024, and I can pick you up. So if you have a question, please call in tonight because I can't see you from here. Anyway, Michael, how are you? You're doing good. Things are happening in the parental alienation world. Tell me what you feel about the movement. You know, when I talk about the disability world, I've been involved in the disability world for children and adults with disabilities for 17 years, and I have seen a huge change in the way people deal with children and adults with disabilities, from institutions to living independently to having jobs and paying taxes. Tell me what you see in the parental alienation world and how that's changed in the time that you've been involved in this arena.
Okay, very good. I think that there's a lot more awareness generally, even from as compared to 15 to 20 years ago. Excuse me, there's quite a bit more awareness. I think that's mostly very, very good, and I say mostly because as a consequence, when there's a little bit of information about it, which is what, you know, when you first learn about something, you just know a little bit at a time, and that in the adversarial environment of the court, that can be sometimes misused. So sometimes there is misinformation. So it's mostly good, but we all find ourselves having to sort of clean up some of the misconceptions about things from time to time. But that's, I'm sure, to be expected. So I think there's a much greater awareness. I think that judges generally, even in more remote areas, are now, I'm seeing them be more open to this understanding. I think any experienced family law judge has seen the phenomenon, perhaps didn't know what to call it exactly, but I think by drawing a line under it and naming it as we've done, that really helps to show how it's just different than two people that can't get along. So I think there's a greater awareness. I think there needs to be, obviously, a great deal more. But we're definitely, there's no question, just no question at all, moving in the right direction.
Terrific. And I see it, you know, just in the last couple of years. I've only been in this area for about 6 years, unfortunately, as an alienated mother. But I can see right now we are on the verge of some kind of explosion that is going to happen, and people are going to get it, and there's going to be a definite change in divorce culture. And I'm so happy that Parental Alienation Awareness Organization is going to be at the helm driving that force into divorce culture change. I'm very proud of our organization and people like you, Mike. And that's the other question is, why are there only a handful of people like you in the United States and really worldwide that are so well-versed in this area? And why don't we have more people concentrating? Because it is so pandemic.
Yes, it is indeed. I think many very qualified forensic psychologists and therapists that work in the field of divorce are exposed to this on a somewhat regular basis, but choosing to specialize in this is, I guess, more of a personal kind of decision. Unfortunately, I think a little bit of information sometimes can lead to a misled conclusion, and I think that does unfortunately happen. I see good forensic evaluators who still are very naive about this to a surprising degree. So that's the this is kind of the first layer of the answer. I think the other layers beyond that is that unless someone has a specific interest in this phenomenon, and I hate to put it that way because it makes it sound like a specimen or something, then a lot of clinicians will basically say, why do I need this in my life? I mean,
well,
these are
not
very
satisfying in the sense that it's very difficult. Why are there so few mental health professionals who treat narcissists or who don't like to treat borderline personality disorders? Because you can't feel good rates of success.
Right. I mean, the best feeling of accomplishment and success that I can describe is when there is an awareness made about this and there's a corrective action taken by the court and the child is released from being in the middle. And now the alienating parent may not be too happy about that, and that's sadly and unfortunately often the case. But still, it's like having someone released from a hostage. Well, it's not like it is having someone released from a hostage situation.
So even though there is progress, there still is enough judges who, when they see the alienation case coming in the door, are not very welcoming. And there's a few good reasons for that. One of the reasons is that we want to believe our orders were the right thing.
Yes.
And not that our orders were meaningless. So we don't feel good about what we're doing.
Well, and one of the things that's
point of view.
Well, I can say also from a research point of view, there was an article published in the American Journal of Family Therapy, 6 months ago by Amy Baker, who is one of our most prolific researchers in this area, who studied what happens in the relationship between a targeted parent and their attorney. That was one part of it, but then also the incidence of violation of orders of the court. And we find that in these cases, the incidence of violation of orders of the court is extremely high. So it's not the judge, it's the way the system kind of operates, because I think what happens a lot of times, these parents will violate an order, and if a judge doesn't have the awareness to realize how serious and significant the violations are, nothing terrible typically happens. Nothing substantive happens as a consequence of that. So they go, oh, this is okay, so they keep doing it over and over again. And then judges get very frustrated. But I think if the judges realized, if they drew a line in the sand immediately at the first violation, and that's what I've seen work, when judges will do that, then it typically it has a big impact on the outcome. But I think the judges, I wish you could clone yourself, Michelle, and sprinkle yourself all over the family court system in the country.
Wouldn't that be
terrific?
It
would certainly help.
But the good thing that we can say, Michelle, is that in January, you're going to start training all of the judges in the state of Illinois about visitation interference and parental alienation, and I think that is amazing.
Wonderful.
What I think is more important is that the litigants, the parents, take that, what you just said, if the judges draw the line in the sand real early on, the litigants have to do that too. They have to go to court immediately. They can't wait and see if it gets better. You really can't, because it's a testing zone for the...
Yeah, oh boy, you're right about that. I mean, that's exactly what this is sort of adolescent testing or something like that. And I can tell you, and you may, you know, you're in your courtroom, so you don't have the opportunity probably to be in lots of other family law courtrooms, but I can tell you that when these chronic violators come through, there's the big thick files that I call the big thump factor when you put it on the desk, judges become irritated as opposed, you know, because it's frustrating, they don't know what to do. But I think if they had a clear direction and the fact that you're going to be giving them that, it's wonderful. I think you should, after you do Illinois, there's several other states, you know. We got 49 other ones.
Well, there's also ways to present your case that you don't put it in the big file. I mean, litigants think that volume equals traction.
Yes.
It does not.
And don't you think, Michelle, when that thump factor comes in with that big file, and I certainly, not being abusive of the courts, but I certainly had a big file because it went on for so many years. I think that that judge turns a blind ear, and when you have judges in so many small counties, maybe not in Cook County, but if I look at Sangamon County, Illinois, where there's three family court judges, two of which never practiced in family law.
Yeah.
Don't want
to
be there. They don't want to hear
right
your
now?
Case. What?
That's what it is right now?
That's what it is right now.
Well, I can tell you, outside of Illinois and in many, many, many places in the country, there are judges who sit on the family bench who really are sort of doing their time in the rotation. And I think,
for retirement.
You're right. So as I like to say, they're not leaning forward. They're kind of leaning back. And I think these are the cases where you have to lean forward and catch things early on.
So it's all in the sound bites of getting the judge's attention in five sentences.
I'm glad you said that. I think that's so important for litigants to appreciate how it's so important to be able to convey a lot in a few words. And that often is not done. I mean, I spend a lot of my time helping people sort of comb the tangles out of their story so that it resonates and so that it acts almost as a template. So these examples basically illuminate the template explains the story.
Doesn't it feel like, as the three of us are talking about this, that creating – I remember when I had to go on book tour – and I was told, and Jill, I know you had the same experience, you have to speak in sound bites.
Right.
And I'm like, no, I can't speak. My sound bite, each thing has three tails. And you know what I mean? And I can't do it. But I learned that the only way people absorb information anymore, unless you're sitting down over a glass of wine and you really want to have heart-to-heart conversations, but the only way people really take in information is quickly, and you got to get their attention immediately. Mm-hmm. It was really hard to learn that. I didn't want to do that because I speak for a living. I wanted it like be juicy and flowy and rhythmical. No, you had to learn to do that, and so do the litigants, because the judge could have 80 cases.
Well,
they'll
all
be exasperated for your case.
They have to understand that they're trying to turn their lives and their children's lives over to a judge who's going to get a snapshot in 5 minutes of what they've been through for the last 3 years.
Let's walk from the top, the grid, and this is how I think. You know, Jill and I are working on a perfection way of presenting this, but the grid is. I mean, I don't know that we're working on it, but we keep talking about it. And the grid is from serious to the beginning stages. So how do the stages, let's start with how the grid works. From the beginning of alienation, what kind of behaviors are included in the beginning stages?
You mean with the litigants, the children, all the above?
With the alienating parent, what starts to happen?
I think here's I think a good way to think about this, and it sort of forms a model with which to think about all these things. A lot of research shows that the best way to protect children is to encourage a relationship protect children from the negative effects of divorce is to encourage the relationship between the child and the other parent. If there are families that do that, they're really, the effect of divorce on those children is not any different than it is from so-called intact families. So with that in mind, basically alienation represents the exact opposite of that. So the early stages of that would be in smaller ways doing things that do not encourage but discourage and make the child feel suspect about the other parent and make the child feel suspicious and that the other parent may be incompetent or not have their best interest at heart. So you'll see small things like calls not being returned and not being encouraged to be returned, and the child comes home from what will end up being the targeted parent, and then the alienating parent becomes kind of cool and aloof around the child, and that sends a message to the child. And then that child may then be a little bit more chilly with the targeted parent the next time, and to which point the alienating parent will think, well, that means they don't want to see them. So it's this cycle that begins like that and then begins to evolve. I don't know if I answered your question.
I think it was a good answer.
you answered
sure
my question. But,
I'm not sure
you know,
that answer fits the question, though.
But a lot of what you just said could also describe what happens in a divorce, a regular divorce.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. And I think that's why in the earlier stages, that's one of the interests I've had is identifying this early on in the process, because you're quite right. Many divorces go through that in the early stages. But they kind of that kind of wears out after a while. What I've found is that when parents who may be doing that, when it's pointed out what it is that they're doing and how harmful that is, they stop. They really, truly don't realize that, and they stop. I think alienating parents will have one of two reactions. They'll say, I didn't do that. Or they'll say, yes, they did, and I'm sorry, but then continue doing it. So there's not a change in that kind of behavior. But at the beginning, it's very hard to separate which is which because, you know, people get divorced because they're not getting along.
Right.
Michael, do you think that alienators, I mean, when I'm working through all of this and trying to make changes in divorce culture, I think if we can make these changes, that we're going to do away with about 80% of alienation in divorce cases. If we can get to these people before they decide it's a tactic that they can maybe use on their ex-spouse. But there's still going to be this other 20% that are going to be narcissistic, selfish people that want to use their children as weapons in the divorce. So what are the characteristics of that alienator? How do you differentiate between what is just a parent going through a divorce looking for some way to maybe hurt that other parent as opposed to an alienator who really wants to destroy that other parent and uses the children at any cost?
I think what you're probably end up describing in that 20% are probably alienating parents that have some sort of an access to personality disorder diagnosis or some mixed bag of those kinds of things. The people that have borderline, narcissistic, and mixtures, and typically those diagnoses are really admixtures of different elements of the same thing, but there's a subset of personality disorders that really share one common characteristic, and that is the inability or the limited ability to critique one's own behavior, to step outside, sort of step off the screen, so to speak, and go back and look at what you did in that incident and go, oh, man, I shouldn't have done that. So these parents don't, imagine if you didn't have the ability to do that. It's something that would, it's going to lead to lots of conflict. And when you get feedback that you're doing that, the response is going to be, no, I'm not. In my opinion, it's a real almost a psychiatric dilemma because you've got people with very little insight. And when people have no awareness of how their behavior impacts others, their ability to change it really is very, very difficult. There's a treatment program called dialectical behavioral therapy that's been actually shown to be pretty effective with people that have these kinds of diagnoses. It's very intensive. It's something that I think probably a court would have to order in order to because these are not people that are particularly open to that.
Wait a minute, a court could order it all day long, and I know tons of alienators that still wouldn't go, Michael.
Yeah, it's not going to be. It'll be like going to, you know.
But what is it?
Well, it's a
behavioral therapy.
Behavioral dialectical therapy is it focuses on behavior. Just to sort of break it down, and the dialectic word, I mean, comes from the coming together of two opposite points of view in a way where the patient gets feedback about their behavior. And they basically, the hook is to get people involved in this is to have them point out to them that they spend a lot of their time being really upset and angry and so forth and feeling wronged and just angry. I mean, these parents are obsessive. I mean, this is their main diet. This is what they do. So using that is the ability to have them sort of step inside, but then it's a pretty regimented individual kind of therapy thing as well, typically as a group thing that goes along with it, whereby there's a process of learning that that ability to critique your own behavior. It's sort of it isn't developed naturally like for people that don't have that problem, but it does appear to work to modify behavior.
Well, what's the offensive to want to critique your own behavior. Well, they have to give, like, I'm training my dog, so all I can think of is, what dog biscuit are they getting?
Right.
I mean
that's
the incentive.
Well, it's the carrot and the stick, really. I mean, so it's if someone is, I remember years ago, I tell this story a lot, I may have already said this, years and years ago, I was seeing in my office one of the trainers for Shamu at SeaWorld, you know, the killer whales. And one of the things that I learned from this person was that when, you know, people explain what they do in their work, and that's a very interesting thing, so I was interested. And it was explained to me that when Shamu is doing things properly, they get the feed, the fish or whatever kind of fish is what it is that they're rewarded with. But when they are not behaving as they are wanted to, one of the most effective ways to extinguish behavior is to disengage. So what the trainer does is turn their back on the killer whale and just stand there. And so when they're acting out that way, there's a disengagement that happens, and that's one of the key learning things that are used in the training of, at least by this person's description of killer whales. Well, behaviorally, we also know that that works with adults too, and it works with children. I mean,
but we also know, Mike, when you turn on a killer whale, that they grab your ponytail and pull you under the water
that's where the analogy stops, probably.
Right, and so I know there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of alienated parents out there, target parents who are saying, but I can, you know, relate to it just firsthand. There are so many orders already violated. How and no rules for these alienators. How are you ever going to get this guy or this girl to go to this specific kind of help for them that really could keep them from being miserable for the rest of their lives? Because what you said, it's true. It's a diet. They eat, sleep, and breathe the destruction of their spouse.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. I think sometimes one of the things that could be considered, if there's going to be, say, a custodial change, one condition about having access to the children, this is more in extreme cases, is that there be a participation in a program like that. I mean, that's not considered outlandish for someone who's a drug addict. I mean, they have to go to AA, NA, and so forth in order to have access to their children, potentially. So I think it's that kind of thing that can leverage participation. I used to do years ago consulting work for chemical dependency treatment place, and we had adults and adolescents, and the adolescents were virtually always court ordered in there, so they didn't want to be there. So one of our first things that we would do is find a way to sort of get them hooked into it and get them to commit to it in all kinds of ways. So if you get somebody there, if you get the warm body there and you interact with them, they have elements of them that will want to connect with you, and then using that to be able to begin to leverage them. But I think you got to get them there first.
Absolutely.
You know what's so funny? I just have to say this because I hope we could talk about some stories tonight. But I have had two mental health professionals in my courtroom. One of them was a psychiatrist who were the most finessed alienators I'd ever seen. And when I was an attorney, I represented two different cases. One of them was the head, way back then, of psychiatry at U of C. And they were alienators. And they had really done a number on their kids in a way that amateurs can't.
Yeah. Oh, boy, I'm sure you're right about that.
So one of the key things, obviously, is if there was like 10 rules that you have to learn about parental alienation, one of them is going to be don't play into their hands,
right.
Don't amp up the conflict, because that's the worst thing you could do for yourself and the easiest thing to want to do. It's the most seductive thing.
Yes.
So can you give us some ways to not play into the hands of the alienator?
The analogy back now, I go back to the killer whale. By disengaging, by not participating in the behavior, it's basic behaviorism 101. So when the ridiculous, I mean, if you think about it, the ridiculous demands and accusations and things that happen that an alienator will spew out really is think about it. It's a way to connect with the targeted parent and to keep them sort of on the line, so to speak, sort of keep a way to keep connected to them. So by not responding in any way, and of course you have to use your judgment on these particular things, that will generally not tend to that will ultimately have the effect of reducing the frequency of those things because it just doesn't work anymore. Now I realize that's difficult to imagine in the complicated world with children, where you have to have pickups and visitations and all kinds of things like that. But I think that's the aspirational goal, is to not play. I mean, just not play. Recognize that every time you do, you're fanning the flames a little bit more.
Because they really want to make you look like they say you are. They want
Absolutely.
To create that character that they're trying to portray to the children and to the public and to your friends and to anybody
Absolutely.
That you came in contact with before. And so if you play into that, you're just feeding their fire.
Yeah, and it may seem perfectly reasonable at the time, because how dare you accuse me of something I didn't do? It's outrageous, of course. But in this context, it's a foolhardy reaction. It's the kind of thing that you have to rise above, and you have to I had a conversation with a guy in British Columbia the other day. You have to become the Buddha.
Yeah.
Michelle, the Buddha.
But yeah. Truthfully, what you're really saying is, if you study, there are so many Buddhist masters who, and tapes and CDs and books, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk, Pema
mm-hmm.
Chodron, she talks about, she's got a CD called Don't Bite the Hook.
Yeah,
and
perfect.
It's four discs on how not to get engaged. It's really smart stuff. And for those who have different religious orientations or philosophies, don't lose the available relief that you could get from this messages. They're astounding. And they said, do this, don't do that. It's really a good resource. So I agree with you.
Oh, I think
I want to stop for just a second. We've got a caller on the line from Texas. Welcome. Are you there, caller? No, I guess they're not there. Never mind. Go ahead, Michael. Sorry.
Well, that's okay. I forgot where I was going.
Broke your train of thought. Sorry.
It's not hard to do sometimes.
Well, we're talking about how not to get hooked in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
I think
everybody knows. So you go to court, you get a lawyer, or you handle it. You just don't engage emotionally, but you do what you have to do. You take care of business, right?
Yes, exactly. And if you think about it, in these kinds of cases, and this is difficult for people to realize at first, I think, in these cases where there is ongoing litigation, let's say, and there are all kinds of issues going on, there really, if you kept a stopwatch on the time you're actually doing something that was directly related to the case, it might be surprising how little time there actually is. But people spend hours and hours and hours poring over it, obsessing about it, thinking about it, because it's so wrong and outrageous, which is understandable. So developing the skill to transcend that, to basically leave that behind and be able to disengage and recognize the lunacy of it, really, and to treat it that way, I think that's a skill that can be learned. I mean, you mentioned Buddhist philosophy, and there's lots of traditions in all Western religious traditions that have analogous things. There's also a whole big bunch of literature from positive psychology now, a lot of research on that shows how to focus on things in ways that make you kind of leave all this stuff behind. And that's, I think, a very important area of development that can be very helpful for people that find themselves in this position.
Okay,
yeah.
Now I really do have a caller from the 312 area code. Do you have a question for Dr. Baum?
Yes, I do. I mean, I know there's a psychiatrist and they're also a lawyer, and they wrote a book sort of the same thing about need to disengage from the alienating parents. But then there's also the balance of the courtroom where we're saying that we have to notify the judge immediately that certain type of behavior is occurring. So now I'm trying to balance the two. Disengage, but notify the court immediately.
That's a very good question. Let me, before I get distracted with something else. Let me respond to that. And that is when you basically you have a checklist of what can I do. You notify the court. What does that mean? That means you file a motion, you set up for a hearing, and then you're done. You're done. You close the book and you go do something else until it's time to show up in court. Whatever preparation you do it then. But then when you're not engaged in that actual behavior, you're disengaged. You're doing something. And it may be something indirectly related to this. If you're, say, haven't seen your children in a long time, there may be some symbolic thing that you're doing by, say, working with children in another capacity that may directly relate to this, but not pull you into the vortex of the alienation itself. That's
Could
a very good question,
though.
Could I
add on for a minute? Here's,
yeah.
Here's the two different scenarios, and it's the most important question that you ask. Scenario number one is you missed your visitation for yet the fifth time. It was canceled because your children were they told you they were sick. They weren't sick. You lose it. You write an angry letter to the mom. You write an angry letter to the children. You call up. You say, you're coming next time. And you do all of this kind of spontaneous, impassioned, irresistible behavior, which plays right into the alienator.
Yes.
Scenario B, you call your lawyer. If you don't have the money for a lawyer, you write out what went wrong. You get your court date. Let's assume you have a lawyer. You show up in court. You file your petition for contempt. You present it in front of the judge. You don't start arguing in the hall. You don't discuss it with your children. You keep it clean without any leaky margins of emotion. That
yeah.
is so powerful, and this is what the judge is going to be looking for. Because
yeah.
if you come in with as angry as you have a right to be, you will not prevail.
I think Michael brought up an important thing very early on, and it has to do with Judge Durant specifically, is as a judge, you don't see what goes on in other courts. I'm an attorney, and I practice in Cook County. But as a judge, generally, you only know what goes on in your courtroom, and you assume other courtrooms are doing the same thing. And part of the issue here is usually alienating parents have survived and have gotten where they are through stuff like perjury and lying to the judge. And here's just another opportunity for them to lie to the judge. And the recognition of parental alienation in most courtrooms is relatively slow. So I'm trying to figure out, how do I present to the judge that this person is an alienating parent? What red flags would work for the judge? How would the judge understand that the person coming before them is an alienator? Obviously,
what
the judge can lie to many times.
Lawyer these days? What I would do?
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, with any luck, I'll never... I would make a chart with the grid on one side of the typical behaviors on stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four. Check off very simply exactly which behaviors have happened, showing the escalation. On that grid, you're going to put the number of missed visitations and show how that is going up. That picture is worth 1,000 words to show that that the behavior is now moving into stage three, stage four. It almost looks like science.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you can make it look like science, the more that the judge is going to appreciate your credibility. That's what I would do. And I have the whole thing, and I've done it, and I've written them. But there's all kinds of ways to do it, so you can be creative, but you get the picture.
Oh, I get the picture. I'm just not as optimistic as you, actually.
What's the difference about your optimism? Why would that play into it?
Well,
your optimism is just something you tell your client, manage your expectations. This is very unpopular. I am going to go in there and fight for you. A lot of times this is not successful.
Michelle, he's speaking from the standpoint of an alienated parent. I know who this is, and he's speaking from the standpoint of an alienated parent and as an attorney, seeing it from both sides. So he's got the double whammy of knowing what goes on as a parent and what goes on as a lawyer.
Yeah, of course he's not optimistic. The fact that optimism has been bled down is why we're doing this show. We're trying to reinvigorate optimism so people keep the fight going. And you're exactly right. Of course you're not optimistic. Whatever the most optimistic person in the world is, you're the opposite. Why wouldn't you be?
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you be? Why wouldn't anybody be? But we can't focus on that part. We can't stare down the hole. We have to look at the stars.
Well,
Let me just add one thing to that, if I could.
Sure, Mike.
And that is this. I mean, I'm involved in all kinds of cases all over the place, and some of them don't work out well, but in the midst of all the mediocre outcomes or even some of the bad ones, there will be a shining good one. There will be a miraculous one that shows that this can be done. I mean, one of the things we focused on in Chicago was, of course, the case of
Dwayne Wade
and how that never should have, by typical standards, that was an outcome no one predicted. But
it was, it brought shock to a few things. And what got me about that case also was, although there was evidence of alienation occurring in certain behavior, it literally took 2.5 years before it was stopped. And it was stopped with the judgment by the judge. But there's a 604B report that's saying this behavior is going on. There were judges that saw this behavior going on for 2.5 years, but it was only the trial judge who stopped it 2.5 years later.
Which would fly directly in the face of the critics who say that Dwayne Wade got his children because he has money.
Right.
That's not what happened. And it takes a long time, even if you're Dwayne Wade. And that's unfortunate. Mick, I hope we answered your question. Keep listening, okay? Thanks. I'm gonna pick up a call now from Texas. Welcome.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Michelle. Dr.
Hi.
Mom. Wendy.
Hi.
It's Wendy. Hey, Wendy. What's up?
It's me.
Hi, Wendy.
What's your question?
I have a question for you from the chat room, and it seems a little unusual. It's for Dr. Bone.
Okay.
This person in chat says that there is a teenager that is living with her target parent, so in a safe environment. But in a counseling session, this teenager has revealed that even though she realizes what has happened, she's not ready to admit that the other parent was alienating her from the target parent, and she still treats the target parent with a great deal of disrespect, which is common because, of course, they feel like they must do that. But what can be done to help this teenager?
Is this do I understand
process?
Correctly that the child is living with the targeted parent to whom he or she treats with disrespect? Is that right?
Yes. My understanding from the question in chat room is that this teenager lived with the target parent, and the teenager has said in counseling that she does realize what happened, but she's not ready to accept that, and she's still treating the target parent with a lot of disrespect.
I think two things. Number one, to steady the counselor with the fact that this is a process, and the fact that the child said this to the counseling session is huge. I mean, that's huge. That falls in that goes in the breakthrough category, and that number one. So I think that's one thing, is to say that this is a process that's begun, and you sometimes can't rush these things. You have to provide the place where it can evolve on its own, and it will. If it started like that, I predict that it certainly will. The other thing is, in talking with the targeted parent, to really get them to do everything they can do so they don't fall for the provocations, because advise them against certainly saying anything negative about the other parent. I mean, you want to be, I'm using this sort of metaphorically, but maybe not. Maybe I'm not. You got to be the Buddha. You got to not react and let all these things wash off. And I think if those two things are done in a matter of time, not too much time, you'll see movement. you'll see probably a lot of them. And I don't know any of the facts of the case, of course, but the dynamic from what you're describing in the question, I suspect that's exactly what it is. So I would caution the counselor against trying to rush this thing, because if that's what happens, that will cause the child to shut down.
Okay. Well, it seems like a breakthrough in itself that the child admitted that at all.
Huge. Huge. Absolutely, because the child in the past, even though the child may in their heart of hearts at 3 a.m. when they wake up in the middle of the night may know that, but the fact that they articulate it to someone that will then probably in some way, directly or indirectly, share it with the targeted parent is absolutely huge.
I want to add something to that. I had a case in my courtroom where they were fighting it out in court for 10 years. Mm. After I asked the husband, the ex-husband, do you think that you could say to your former spouse that you apologize for anything you had done that caused her pain? Which was shocking to them, and shocking that I asked, and shocking to the deputy, because we had lived with this case for a long time. He turned around and he said to her, I do. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for any pain that I caused you. I don't even know how we've been doing this for 10 years.
Wow.
She says back to him, she breaks down hysterical crying. He starts crying. See, they've been holding it. They thought they had moved on with their life. They were frozen. They had never moved on a day. So, but here's the point that targets the question. They decided to go out and have coffee. They did this healing thing. They both were hysterical, and then they hugged. 10 years, mom had alienated the child totally. Didn't want to be with dad. When the child, who was 17, was in the hall, and I said, shall we tell your daughter what just happened here? My thinking that she was going to be thrilled. As a matter of fact, they announced it to her. She was stunned. Her mother had taught her how to live in the swamp. Her mother abandoned her in the swamp by forgiving dad, and now she was in it by herself. And she was furious. Why did you teach me to hate him and then change your mind? This poor kid is major into a loyalty bind. He's already been enculturated. Of course it's going to, just like you say. But this is what happened. It's all, she's programmed.
Well, Mike, what tools are available to these kids? I mean, as we said earlier in the show, there's only a handful of people in the world that even know how to work with this. How do you deal with these kids? You can't just send them to a counselor in Podunk, Utah, that has never dealt with this before. What do you do to give them the tools to try to work their way through this, because they're so stuck and scared and not knowing?
I think the bag of tricks is really pretty small. And what I do with a somewhat regular basis is I'll be on the phone with some therapist somewhere in Podunk or somewhere like that will be involved in a case like this or potentially will be, and we'll say, I don't know what to do. I think I see what's going on, but I don't know what to do. And then we might talk for a little while on the phone and sort of convey some principles, just what I said a moment ago, really. And the principles are recognizing that any crack in the shell where there's a recognition of what's going on is very, very significant, but you don't jump all over it and shine a light on it and want to put a frame around it and call a press conference. I mean, what you want to do is let it be and let the person grow. I think I had an email exchange with you, I think, Jill, where the analogy, I was feeling very poetic that day. It's sort of like this is a seedling, and if a seedling starts to sprout and you put too much sunlight, too much water, too much fertilizer, it'll kill it. So I think this is the analogy is that of more of a plant than a machine. You can't sort of crack it open and fix it. It has to grow. And I think that's what a recognition of something like that for the counselor would be very, very important. As far as what to do with kids in that situation is that you basically get them, just ask them, well, what do you think? And have them be able to see, one of the things, as you, I'm sure, all know, I mean, one of the things that really is not developed and even penalized for developing is independent critical thought. I mean, these kids are penalized for having their own independent thought. So by asking a child, well, what do you think and why, and help me understand that, not in a confrontational way, but in a way just a conversational, I want to understand why you're thinking that. So that makes sense to me, I guess, but explain why. And having that kind of exchange that's not heavy and laden and so forth, because these kids are really tight and ready to, well, just I think, Michelle, what you described is a very good example of that, and I think you described it absolutely correctly. I mean, she was abandoned in the swamp and betrayed by forgiving the father. I mean, so, yeah, this kid's going to be very tight and very ill at ease and so forth. So in that particular example, I mean, that kid needs to be with someone that understands this and can be patient with her unfolding as how this works.
But do you want to know what happened in that case? Got pregnant. The mother was furious with her. She went to live with her dad. She knew that would happen because her mother said, I'm the perfect parent.
Yeah, so I've heard.
And
yeah.
Now she's still living with her dad.
It makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, but,
I mean,
not to go back to that story, but just to emphasize what you were saying, and you said something either the last time we interviewed you or you said it at the conference. And it has to do with the most important thing is, which you just made the sapling and the over-fertilized, let them remember what they liked about you.
Yes.
Ease that in like a slow puddle, not like flood.
Yeah, exactly. And it's got to be slow because you'll get pushback if it's too fast.
Well, what about this thing about giving space to your kid when he says, you know, I don't want to see you right now. Let me have some space. How do you gauge, how do you surf that? What does that mean?
Well, now, I mean, is this in an alienation situation where there's visitation, that sort of
thing? The child is saying, well, I don't want to come, I'll come in a month, but I don't want to come right now. Let me just my way. And
my response to that is there needs to be an order in place that's clear and that is I don't want to say enforceable, but in a way I do, so that basically when a child says, well, I'm sorry you feel that way, we can talk about it, but I'll be there to pick you up at 7, and then you show up and pick them up at 7 and you talk about it as you need to, and then you talk about something else, and it's sort of, I hate to say it, but it's almost treated, those objections almost treated dismissively.
I want to interrupt you guys for just a second because the phone lines are going crazy, and I've got a couple of callers I'd like to pick up just before we've got about 8 minutes left. I've got a call from the 200 area code. Are you there? Caller? Let's grab this one. Call from the 321 area code.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Hi, I'm calling about a specific case, and I'd like Dr. Bone's opinion on it. As a teacher, when a child falls in my classroom and gets a scrape on the knee, I have to make a report to the nurse, I have to call the principal, I have to call the house monitor, I have to tell everybody that the child fell. Do you understand?
Yes.
Okay. And if someone touches a child on the arm that might even look inappropriate or maybe touching near the breast, I have to call the police, I have to call the monitor, I have to call the principal, I have to turn it into all those people. That's the law. I'm watching a case in Florida, and I'm sorry, I'm like a dog with a bone. I can't let it go. This man was ordered to pay for a $100,000 report, which he paid for, and his hands and his mouth are gagged, and he's not allowed to talk about what's in it. But you know what? I'm not under any gag. And I want to say that in that report it states that the mother sent the eldest child to the local drug dealer to buy the drugs, bring them back to the house so that she and her boyfriend could get high. And the drug dealer was interviewed, and that is part of the report. And four judges, none of them have admitted that this report exists. So the reason I'm calling is to make it sure that it goes on record somewhere that this report does exist, that it claims and it clearly proves that these people were on drugs. The one who has the kids is on drugs, and year after year, the case drags on in court, year after year. It's now 11 years. The kids are completely alienated from the parent. My goodness. If a child in my classroom falls and scrapes a knee, I have to call the police.
So I guess, caller, your point
How
is
How does this happen?
That,
Wait
that,
a minute. Why isn't the judge, why doesn't he have any responsibility? Do the judges not report to anyone? Do they not
Mike,
have
do
any
you
responsibility?
Comment? Thanks, caller. I'll have Mike comment, and then Michelle can follow up. Thank you, caller.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Thanks. Go ahead, Michael. Michael, are you there? I think we lost Mike Bone for just a second. That's a shame. Hopefully he'll call right back in. I know the case that that caller was talking about in Florida, and it is an incredibly volatile case, has been going on for a long time. And if we can get Mike Bone back on the phone in just a second, he will comment on that case. I'm going to take a call from the 970 area code right now. Welcome, caller.
Hi, this is Margie. Hi, Jill. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Margie. How are you?
Good. I tried to get on chat, but I couldn't get on there. Listen, I just want to say thank you for all your continued education and awareness. And Michael was talking about, you know, when you have these little window of opportunities, how they're just little seedlings. And I have seen that in with my situation.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, we went through a horrendous custody battle, and it was just terrible. There's just what you're talking about, with no accountability. And so I don't know, you know. I mean, I like, too, what Judge Michelle was saying about being a Buddha, and that's awfully hard to do when you're watching your children in front of you become brainwashed. But I think that really, you know, is a key. And I know I canceled my whole court involvement. And I had to step aside because it was just complete battering, not only of the kids, but of me and my whole family. And, you know, stepping back has been the best thing.
Well, Margie,
the right thing
one.
To do? What?
Well, and that's a question we should ask Dr. Bone. He's rejoined us, and so is Michelle. I don't know what happened,
right,
but everybody kind of
God
popped out right
her.
There.
I think he really heated up the phone connection.
Yes, I think he did, too, and I think he blew our connections.
We didn't have enough batteries for her.
But, Mike, what Margie is asking, or what she's saying, she's from Colorado, Fort Collins, Colorado, and I know her well, and I know her situation. And what she's saying is she has taken a step back because it's been really a lot for her to deal with. So when do you step back? When do you stop? What are the limits with all of this? Can you address that?
Yeah, I think that's a hard question, but I think the answer, the best I can do for an answer is, as sort of related to an earlier question, where there are things you can actually do in a given case that are specific actions you can take. If there are those still remaining, then it's advisable to do them. But after all the avenues have been exhausted at that point, then I think it makes more sense to step back. And the system's certainly far from perfect, and I think most family law judges are not like Judge Lawrence on our call today. So I think that's a reality of it, and that's we have a lot more work to do as far as educating judges.
That's for sure.
Yeah,
but
and
we're
it's coming
it.
Around. It's just and there's a. I just want to say because I so appreciate the compliments. There's not a lot like Michelle. I do appreciate that, but there are much more than you think. I'm definitely not the only one.
Well, I
say
you're
that.
Not. Yeah. There's not a lot like Michelle that are flamenco dancers.
Take it. Sold. I'll take it.
Margie, thank you for your call. I'm gonna disconnect and. Mike, can you just quickly address the caller that we had before we were disconnected about the case in Florida and a judge not reading a report that was done by a custody evaluator and just continuing on with the case for 11 years?
One of the problems, this will sound to me unreasonable, and I think it is unreasonable. One of the problems is sometimes these big, long reports don't get read. I know of one case also in Florida where there's an evaluation that's 150 pages, and I am pretty certain the judge has not been read by the judge. I think that's
Oh, you're supposed to read them?
I'm sorry?
Good one. Supposed to read them? Yeah.
I mean, I'm sad to say that I think that happens more than I would like to believe that it happens. So there's a lot of information that never gets. I mean, judges are so. I mean, my sense of it, enormously busy, and they go get up, you know, each case comes through, and there's, you can sort of see them going, well, let's see now, which, what's the story here, and, you know, going through whatever system they develop for themselves to remember these things. But then in the meantime, between cases, there are these big reports to read. And I've seen when the, you can tell when a judge has read the report in it, because they'll ask specific questions about it. And very, but sometimes, and in that case, probably it wasn't read. I hate to say that, but it might be the case.
Well, unfortunately, we have a lot of work left to do. We're working towards a terrifically positive end, but we've got still a lot of steps to take. And, Michael, you're in the forefront. You're in the Army. I'm in the Army. Michelle's in the Army. And all these people that are listening tonight are working towards that end. We thank you so much for your time tonight, and we hope to do it again. We're a good trio, I think.
I couldn't agree more.
I'm the general.
Well, I don't know about that. I feel like we're all sort of I think we're all the heads of each branch of the service.
That's it. You're exactly right. Well, everybody, tune in next time. We'll have Mike on again. Michelle, thank you. And
wonderful.
We thank you all for calling
thank
in tonight.
Thank you so
much, I still
Dr.
have calls
Bone.
I can't even get to,
well,
which
thank,
I feel bad
thank
about.
Well, thank you. Both. It's always a pleasure, and it's always thoroughly enjoy it. So I'll be glad to do it again sometime.
Terrific. Wonderful. And
thanks,
you will.
Guys.
Take care.
And
have
you
a terrific
will.
Weekend.
Bye-bye.
All right. All bye-bye. Right.
Bye-bye. Caller, are you there?
Hello, that was awesome.
Is that you?
It's me.
Okay, good. I'm sorry. I was trying to get back to you, but you called when you called in before, you were 111, which I knew was Skype, and when you called back in, you came to 200, and I didn't know it was you. So, but that was a good show, wasn't it?
Well, it was awesome. You've got to have him on again.
I know.
I kept getting booted out. I had to keep calling back in.
Oh, you did? Oh, I'm sorry. And I don't know what happened. There were so many calls. There was like 43 calls. I couldn't get to everybody.
Wow, he is great.
So, yeah, he did a good job. Thank you for calling with that, because that was actually one of my questions. That's what Cindy sent me, that story.
Yeah.
And I have that actually laying in front of me. So I'm glad you did that. That was terrific. So
yeah,
I'm going to dinner, and I will – can I call you in the morning?
Of course.
Okay, I'll call you in the morning.
I'm off for the next 2 days. So,
oh, good.
Okay. I'll call Robert in the morning, and then we'll talk about that.
Oh, okay. Just call me when you're done with that.
All right, I will. That was awesome.
All right. Thanks.
Okay, see
you. Love you,
awesome.
Bye.
Bye. Love you, bye.